Is Brexit like death? Potentially deferred, but never fully aborted. It's starting to look that way. The European Council has extended the UK's Article 50 notice to the 31st of October. Halloween might be an ominous date for Brexit Britain, but whose nightmare will it prove to be? The biggest story in Brussels is that Britain stands alone. While 27 member state countries decided the UK's fate, Theresa May was having dinner at the ambassadorial residence. It seemed like Europe had finally lost patience with Brexit Britain.
You're an old ally of Britain. Is your patience wearing thin?
For some time now, yes.
You cannot betray the 6 million people who signed the petition to revoke Article 50, the 1 million people who marched for a people's vote, or the increasing majority of people who want to remain in the European Union. They are Europeans. Thank you.
That's where we are on this episode of the Another Europe is Possible podcast with Luke Cooper, a visiting fellow at the IWM. Joining us on today's show is Ruth Vordak, professor of linguistics and a leading critic of the European far right. To feedback to us on today's podcast, you can get us on Twitter at @another_Europe, and you can also get us on facebook.com/AnotherEuropeIsPossible. Hope you enjoy it.
Hi, Ruth. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Luke.
So, look, do you want Britain to stay, or have you had enough, and do you want Britain out?
Well, I think this question cannot be answered in this either-or. I think many of us would like Britain to stay, have always wanted Britain to stay, have never enjoyed a view that Britain would actually leave the European Union. And having worked myself in Lancaster for 12 years and taught there, I have very close relationships to many colleagues and to the country as such. Thus, I was actually appalled by the result of the referendum. And when the referendum happened, I was visiting senior fellow at the Schuman Center in Florence at that time. And I remember all of us were absolutely shocked and dismayed. And in that way, coming back to your question, I would, of course, like Britain to remain. On the other hand, and in that way, I understand Donald Tusk completely, who seems really sad about this whole affair. On the other hand, I also understand Emmanuel Macron and many others who are sick and tired of having to think about another delay or not, because there are many challenges for the European Union right now which should be debated and discussed. Hi, Luke. And somehow the debate is stuck and paralyzed by the Brexit dilemma. So I can understand many heads of states and many governments and many people who just want to get on with global warming, poverty, inequality, the danger posed by the far right, etc., etc., and having constantly to meet and debate about another postponement and another delay without seeing any really progress is difficult.
And it seems in that sense to cross left and right, doesn't it? It's not that there's a left in the rest of Europe that's clamouring over itself to keep Britain in. On the other hand, there's not a right in Europe that's clamouring over itself to get Britain out. I mean, Donald Tusk is the exemplary example of that. He's from the Polish centre-right originally. I think you and I would disagree with many positions he's argued over the years on neoliberal policy and restructuring in Greece and elsewhere. But it kind of throws everything in the air on this question in quite a unique way. I was just wondering, looking forward to the European elections, how do you think this question will affect Europe.
It's difficult to have a European perspective because that's very heterogeneous, as you've just said. Not just left and right, it's young and old, it's urban and rural, it's people who know Britain or people who don't, etc. I think for the European election, it does pose many questions. Will the British MEPs who will be elected take the parliament seriously or not? Because obviously they might be leaving soon afterwards. So what you do in this period of 4 or 5 months, for myself, the European Parliament is a very important institution. I actually studied it and I did ethnography in the European Parliament. I wrote a book about that, and I have big admiration for the European parliamentarians and for the parliament. Many people think the parliament doesn't do anything and these people just get very big salaries and have a good life. They actually do a very big job there. It's a lot of work. It's very stressful. And it's the only institution in the EU which gets elected by all of us. So I think it has a very important function, and it also got quite a few powers quite recently, some years ago, powers of veto, powers of actually being able to choose the commissioners, which is very important, to refuse commissioners, etc. So I think the parliament has to be taken very seriously. And that is one danger, which was already mentioned by some of the Brexiteers, that they won't take it seriously. So I understand that that could pose a problem. The other issue is that the far right, which obviously will even now form a closer alliance, which Salvini is just constructing, who's the Italian Minister of Home Affairs and probably, one could say, a fascist in many of his policies and also utterances, but also a very charismatic politician, they will not propose exit anymore. So the British example and the dilemma and the problems have scared the far right. So there is no talk now about Grexit, Italexit, Exit, and all of these other nation states exiting. I think people are scared. So that's a good thing. On the other hand, having a British far right now get many votes is also scary, because there, I've seen one poll for the European Parliament suggesting that if Britain votes, the European far right might get most votes and come first place. So that's very scary. There are many other dimensions. There's, of course, also the possibility that the left might get many more votes via Labour and get stronger than the European Conservatives. So there's speculation about all of that. My biggest issue actually is the problem which Macron also emphasized. Will the British MEPs block European policies until they get out or stay in? I don't think that one can have some kind of decision-making on that, because you cannot tell people what they will say or not say or vote for or not vote for. So that, I think that is empty talk, what the EU is deciding on right now, that the British have to keep to these and that rules or not. I think that is dangerous.
I suppose one of the big considerations here is the parliament is one thing, but another side of things is what Britain and the British government does. So thinking about the next 4 or 5, 6 months, a year, if we can even think that far in British politics, one of the key factors will be whether Theresa May remains Prime Minister. Because I know in the week before the European Council, Jacob Rees-Mogg, who's obviously on the hard right, if I think we can legitimately call it that now, of the British Conservative Party, came out on Twitter and said the UK government should disrupt, we should block, we should use the veto wherever possible on as many questions as possible if we are forced against our will to stay in. Very inflammatory rhetoric that naturally Theresa May immediately distanced herself from. Now, the question that we don't know is that Theresa May is constitutionally protected inside the Conservative Party until December because she survived that vote of no confidence. Will the great and the good of the Tory party be successful in nudging her aside? I suspect that they won't be, actually, or that they won't want to, because there is just the danger that once she goes, the mad people take over. And there's still a majority of MPs in the Conservative Party who aren't, quote-unquote, the mad people who just want to crash out with no deal. So that means that I really think we might be in for a kind of zombie series of extensions. And here, you know, one would have to sympathise with Macron and maybe other leaders who are arguing that a series of rolling extensions, we get to October 31st, well, is it then extended again to a year later? And I don't honestly know how that will play out, because it's a bit like a poker game that's going on in a way. Because I imagine if we get to October 31st and the EU says no to a further extension, the UK Parliament would find the courage to revoke Article 50. But because the EU27 want to avoid no deal, they would be taking an extraordinary risk 2 days before October 31st by saying, well, actually, we're not going to extend. So you just have one choice, revoke, and that's it. And you just have to wonder whether around that table amongst those 27 countries they would roll the dice in that way. It seems with all of the problems that Europe is facing, the temptation of Merkel, of Tusk, of others would be to not call Britain's bluff and try to get the revoke and risk no deal, but get the extension.
First of all, the outcome of the European Parliament election will be decisive and very important. So if the far right really gains a lot of votes, people like Macron and Merkel will be challenged in their own countries. And if the AfD gains a lot of votes, if Front National, Rassemblement National now gains a lot of votes, that might cause a lot of problems for those two leaders. The same is true in other countries. And thus it's difficult to predict, because of course national interests always override European interests. And we know that from many studies, not just in the UK. It's almost impossible for somebody like me to see the British debate changing in these next 5 months. I don't know what would have to happen. It seems to be from outside so paralyzed or so stuck that only really an election could change something. And maybe that's what Labour is going for. I have no clue, but it seems from outside that that's something which might happen if no compromise is possible between the Tories and Labour for the customs union. So that's difficult to predict. But if it just goes on and on like that, I think patience will just go out. And even if Merkel is very frightened and almost on going out of politics, so it's really her last years, which she's now doing as chancellor. There's a new head now of the Conservative Party, the CDU-CSU in Germany, Krampauer, and Angela Merkel's last turn right now as German chancellor. It's over. after that term, whenever the new elections will take place, which means that one big factor of stability will be gone. I mean, you don't have to agree with Angela Merkel's policies in all points, which I'm sure you and I don't, Luke, but all in all, she has been a center of stability against the rise of the far right. There's no question about that. And Macron, on the other hand, is facing big challenges inside and is the one loud voice outside for European integration and the fight against the far right. So those two have obviously big interests in ending sort of the never-ending story with Britain, and they, I think, both would be very happy if Britain would stay. And I don't know, of course, what kind of strategies those two heads of state or chancellor and head of state have agreed on, but it might be some kind of good cop, bad cop strategy. Merkel is right now being very helpful, and Macron is putting very clear limits. But looking at Austria, which also has a big say in this so-called game, and it has unfortunately been a game from the outset, I find it one of the most irresponsible things ever since the end of World War II, especially in Britain, a very, very irresponsible decision to hold such a referendum. But in any case, from the Austrian perspective, Chancellor Kurz, who's conservative and the chancellor of a far-right government, has actually also emphasized that they want a very short extension. Again, yesterday in the late-night news, Minister Blümel, who's the Minister for European Affairs, emphasized and repeated that they actually don't want the British to take part in the European elections because it's going to make everything difficult. And he mentioned Rees-Mogg and sort of the danger coming from British MEPs blocking and vetoing. So the Austrian position is very clear. I mean, they want things to stop soon. And Kurz, of course, having had the European presidency in the fall, and they were very much involved in the negotiations, doesn't want his part of the negotiation to look as he had failed. Yeah, so there's this interest as well. Looking at all these national dangers, especially in the light of the rise of the far right, it's very difficult to predict what Merkel and Macron will have to say in October 2019. Right now, I only have the vision of Halloween, you know, sort of the British ghosts going around asking for, what you call that in English? You know, the knocking on the doors, like, you know, a very strange date.
I like this idea of the good cop, bad cop, so it's not a weakening of the Franco-German axis in the centre of Europe, but actually a kind of routine to manoeuvre around interests and to protect the European Union, to give them their due on that point. The unity of the EU27 has been pretty remarkable, especially when Germany and the Netherlands stand to lose a lot economically, and France stands to lose too, but probably not quite as much as those two states from a no-deal hard Brexit, and then clearly have stood in a lot of solidarity with Ireland on the open border and protection of the Good Friday Agreement. Maybe our horizons or assumptions are too low. Maybe they should have been expected to stand alongside Ireland. But I'll say two things, one about the European elections and then one about the timing of October 31st for Britain and what we could anticipate then, because it's party conference season. So on the European elections, well, the interesting thing is that Britain has quite a lot of seats, 75, and it can make a big difference in how they go in the European Parliament. So it does seem very plausible that anti-Brexit parties will do well. Now, depending on whether you consider Labour to be an anti-Brexit party, which is somewhat ambiguous, but they are increasingly pivoting towards an anti-Brexit stance. and they have a very good chance of winning the election. But we also have the new party, Change UK, that will probably do very well because they're clearly anti-Brexit. The Green parties will do well. The Scottish Nationalists will no doubt do well in Scotland, and so on. So anti-Brexit parties and progressive forces more generally stand to do very well. Labour indeed may win the election itself, which would be the first time in 2 decades. So since 1999, they've actually won a European election. Now, the interesting thing about what that means for the European Parliament is that they could potentially make the difference in who becomes president of the Commission. Because if they make the Social Democracy, the Party of European Socialists, the largest party with the biggest popular vote, then the assumption on the existing Spitzenkandidat system is that that means Timmermans, the Social Democratic candidate, would become president of the European Commission. So, whoop, the Socialists take back the European Commission with the help of Brexit Britain. Now, the Tories, on the other hand, would stand to do very badly because they will be attacked by pro-Brexit parties, not only UKIP, but the new party called the Brexit Party. There was even one unnamed Conservative MEP quoted recently, I think it was in The Guardian, who said that they would be voting for the Brexit Party. So he obviously couldn't say that on the record. He would be expelled from the Conservatives. But nonetheless, the assumption is that they will do very well and the Tories will do very badly. So I think that that's quite an opportune moment for Remain forces. It creates the funny paradox in Europe that because the exit agreement that has been established at the European Council, what's called this flexible extension, so with 1 month's notice, Britain could still just leave at any time between now and the end of October. So weirdly, Britain could help the Socialists take hold of the European Commission and then leave the European Union. And that's kind of, I don't know what would happen in that circumstances. It does seem to be something of a constitutional crisis or a contradiction if that were to happen. But on the conference season in the UK for our mainland European audiences, in September and October, all of the political parties in the UK have party conferences, and that creates a big opportunity, particularly for anti-Brexit groups inside the Labour Party, to make one big heave again and push the party firmly towards a Remain and Reform stance. And if they're successful in getting that in party policy, so groups like Another Europe Is Possible and others campaigning on the conference floor, then that means in the last 4 weeks of the new extension period, Labour could be in a very pro-Remain, anti-Brexit space. It all seems quite exciting to me. I mean, one friend who has applied to run as MEP for the Labour Party said to me on WhatsApp earlier today, yeah, the short extension, it's a bit disappointing really, isn't it? We're going to stand as MEP candidates, we might get elected and then we'll be out in 6 months. So I was like, puh, what pessimism. Britain is not leaving the European Union.
Well, as I say, it's a very interesting, exciting and complex perspective. And on the other hand, it's also challenging in the sense that the EU could still be paralyzed by it. So I think in many ways it could look more exciting from inside the UK than from outside the UK, where there are pressing issues to be debated. I'm somebody who reads The Guardian every day and various other also English, British newspapers. If I just think of the vision of reading about Brexit every day again the entire summer, it gets quite exhausting and boring, actually. On the other hand, what you said about the party conferences, which I know always take place in the fall, that maybe the selection of the date is very much justified, that it's after the various party conferences and there could be a big move to remain, at least in Labour, and that might be very important. Timmermans getting to be president of the Commission would, of course, be a very interesting perspective. And I don't know what kind of legislation would actually take place if those MEPs would leave again. I have absolutely no clue if the EU knows that. So what happens if these people are all elected, the Commission is elected, the Commissioner gets a majority, not only via Spitzenkandidat, but also just by majority of votes, and then some of these MEPs have to leave again, and would that mean that the elections would have to be repeated? Would Timmermans, for example, remain as next president after Juncker? This is sort of a situation which has no precedent. And that is something which, I don't know if I'm frightened, but anyway, I think it's a big problem. Because then the EU would have to do a zillion meetings about all of that and discuss and maybe have new elections, not new elections, this, that, and the other, instead of thinking about the big global challenges. China, the US, and, you know, there's a big list. And I don't like that perspective.
I mean, I don't know about the Commission president and what that would mean. I mean, it seemed it would be an incredible contradiction. You would have thought that there would have to be a rerun. On the actual distribution of the seats, the system that they had is put in place to redistribute the seats if Brexit happened. Yeah. So that's relatively straightforward because it's a party list system. So the next person on the party list comes and takes up the seats that they wouldn't otherwise take. But then on the Commission president, seems a very peculiar situation.
I mean, Timmermans was interviewed on Austrian television some days ago because he was in Vienna, sort of supporting the campaign of the Austrian social democracy. I think he was in television last Friday in the late night news. He was quite optimistic about winning, that the left or the progressive would win. He didn't say the left, he said the progressive. Now, I would interpret this as the liberals, the greens, the socialists, the left, and the social democrats. Yeah? So everybody who's not on the far right and the right. And I think that is what they are trying to now build up, a huge sort of coalition of all progressive forces, especially after Salvini's alliance now.
The Frei Partei here in Austria has supported the Salvini alliance. I think it's called for a Europe of Common Sense that he established last week. What's your understanding of how networked and organised these European far-right parties are? I think they're anticipating winning something like 150 seats, the far-right broadly defined in the European Parliament, out of 750. So it's still a minority, but it will be one of their best ever votes.
They think about 20% or more. They're certainly well linked, much better than we used to think, because they're very professional in their social media outreach and in the transnational links, and having now had to unfortunately also investigate the transnational links of the identitarians in the last weeks, because it turned out that the Austrian identitarians had connections to Christchurch and the terrorist murder there. It seems that the identitarians are very well linked transnationally, and the far right is linked to the identitarians and vice versa. I know this well because of the Austrian links, because in Austria the identitarian movement started 2012, and they actually use very similar concepts and notions as the FPÖ has since ever. Yeah, since ever means since the 60s and 70s, and even more so since the 90s. And so the transnational links, I think, are bigger than we think, because they haven't really been investigated that well yet. The social networks are huge. It seems that Steve Bannon has supported and advised Salvini and has a bureau in Rome and also one in Brussels. So we don't know how much money and what Stephen Bannon has really given to the far right, because I know that the Austrian far right actually rejected Bannon's help. But it seems that there is a huge network. And as I said, we've seen the impact of that network now under investigation via Christchurch and the Identitarians.
Lots of people in Austria are focusing on the organisational links, though. But you've been pointing out the organisational links are really secondary, because it's the politics and discourse which is so similar, and that's what we should be drawing attention to.
Yeah, I think the separation and division of these movements and parties cannot really be achieved by separating people from these movements or kicking them out of movements, asking them to leave, cancelling rents and bureaus and all of that. What we have seen is that the overlap of ideologies is enormous, and some concepts like replacement, which is the major concept or salient concept of the Identitarians, the name of the testimonial of the Christchurch murder, and replacement was also part and parcel of Breivik, who murdered over 80 young adolescents in Norway, and who also already quoted the FPÖ in his testimonial. So we know that the concepts are salient. It's not just the words, it's the ideologies which are condensed in such concepts, like replacement, or to say the German words, Umvolkung, Überfremdung, and sort of similar concepts which have a long history, actually, going back to Nazi jargon, etc. That's why I'm absolutely sure that any separation can only happen if such ideologies are put to rest. And that is also what I said recently in a press conference where I was present. The books of the Freedom Party, their programs have to be rewritten, and these ideologies have to be replaced, now using replaced in a different sense, before one can even believe that there is really a distancing and separation from these very dangerous identitarian movements.
And that really underlines the battle for the soul of Europe. And seen in that context, it's impossible not to conclude that whether one island on the northwest corner of Europe stays inside the European Union, the battle for the soul of Europe between the left and right, the far right, what kind of Europe we want in the future, and whether we're going to allow this far-right takeover of European societies is going to continue. So thanks for bringing that perspective. It's been so good to talk to you again, as ever, and we'll no doubt thank we'll have you back on the show in the future.
Thank you, Luke, very much for including me. We will miss you in Vienna, but I think we will meet again.
Thanks to Ruth, and thanks to you for listening. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please leave us a rating or review on your podcast platform. You can find a full back catalogue of podcasts on anotherEurope.org, where you can also join the campaign and follow us on Twitter at another_Europe. We'll be back very soon. See you then.